The new working document for the upcoming Synod on Synodality was released this week. Some reports say the hot topics are off the table. But are they really? And what's the fallout from the excommunication of Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano? The Papal Posse, Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal are here with analysis. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. If you'd like to comment on tonight's show, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo. Lots to cover tonight. First, some news. Fire broke out on Thursday in the spire of the 1,000-year-old Notre Dame Cathedral in Rouen, France. Authorities say the flames started in a spire that was being renovated. The historic Gothic cathedral is well known from a series of paintings by French Impressionist Claude Monet. Crews worked to protect the rest of the cathedral from water damage, but first responders had the blaze under control within 90 minutes. The incident is reminiscent of the 2019 fire that nearly destroyed Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, which is scheduled to reopen this December. Now, this blaze is being reported as a construction-related accident. But in France, they have seen hundreds of cases of anti-Christian vandalism of churches in recent years. And the Instrumentum Laboris, the working document for that October meeting of the Synod on Synodality, has been released. This initiative by Pope Francis seeks to get bishops and laity conversing about teachings, even disciplines of the church. The 30-page document that will guide these synodal discussions was presented at the press conference by Cardinals Mario Grech and Jean-Claude Hollerich. How is this document different from last year's? And what new ground might be broken this year? With analysis of that, more is the Papal Posse, editor-in-chief of the CatholicThing.org, Robert Royal, and canon lawyer and priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. I want to start with this working document. It is 30 pages long, divided into six sections, which I don't want to get into. They've got sections on prayer and discernment for those participating in these discussions. But, Father, before we get into the specifics, your initial reaction to how this synodal plan or discussion plan compares to the previous editions?
I would say it's more or less the same trajectory, which is to try to define for us what is a synodal church, which is kind of a mystery because it can mean whatever the church authority says it means. There's, again, the experience of reading a document and your eyes glazing over incomprehensible jargon. You have suggestions being made in the name of submissions coming from all over the world. We can examine some of them, but it's basically a committee document full of jargon, and it's all reinforcing the position that we're at a pivot point in history because the church is going to become synodal and people are going to be happy because good things are coming. And my reaction is, I don't think so.
Okay. Well, you know, this is part of what I love, this part of the work that we do here, because we spend time actually reading this stuff. So, frankly, the viewer and the public doesn't have to. And it's really the only place you can get unvarnished reaction to what's really happening in these documents. Bob, we are already seeing some reports suggesting that the hot button, the controversial issues from last year's Synod are now off the table. Is that how you see it after reading this document?
Well, yes and no, because the document is, it's not only this jargon and this word salad that Father was talking about. It kind of affirms things and it denies them at the same time. And, you know, I have to say my first reaction as I was reading through it, because I've sometimes been a university teacher, is it's like you've assigned a 30-page document. You know, you have your committee that's supposed to write, you told them, write 30 pages. But the student starts to write, and after five pages, he doesn't have anything else to say, and he keeps repeating the same thing over and over again. Now, there is this.
It does have that quality.
There is this difference. If you remember, the previous document had all kinds of worksheets, and it was like being in fifth or sixth grade where, you know, you come up with three responses to this question and whatnot. So it's a lot shorter, and it stays away from that kind of meddling with the conversation. And as we've since learned, there are 10 study groups.
Yeah, well, we're going to get into that.
Yeah, but I just want to say that those controversial issues have been pushed off to the study groups.
Yes.
So what you have here is a document that says, how can we be a synodal church in mission, which presumably means going out to the world to preach the gospel. But what it talks about is almost everything that occurs within the church. It's sort of a self-referential document, much, much more than it is an outward-pointed document.
Yeah, I love how the document just references earlier synodal documents from this papacy. It just keeps kind of, it's a circular sort of reference. But at a time when they're saying we shouldn't be repeating the past and caught in a cycle, we've got to move forward. So it's very confusing. But remember the decision to bless gay unions? That wasn't discussed at the synod, nor the decision to essentially outlaw the traditional Latin Mass. Well, now, following the Grench press conference, the Holy See revealed, as Bob alluded to, the discussion group of female ordination. That will be delegated to an outside study group, not part of the synod. Here's the press note. The in-depth study of the issues in question, in particular the question of the necessary participation of women in the life and leadership of the church, has been entrusted to the Dicastery of the Doctrine of the Faith, under the coordination of the Secretary for the Doctrinal Section, Monsignor Armando Matteo, and in dialogue with the Secretariat General of the Synod. The Dicastery has begun its study according to the procedures established in its own regulations with a view of the publication of the special document. Oh, I'm glad we're here to translate. Father, how many study groups are they going to task with this question of female ordination? I wish they would give this much attention to, say, financial and sexual malfeasance in the church. But what does it tell you?
Well, it tells me that they've lost sight of the role of the synod. In its origin, the synod was not part of the Roman Curia. It was a group of bishops who came into Rome to advise the Pope on questions that the Pope would bring before them. Well, now, under the guise of a synodal discussion, we're going to have a curial study of an issue, and then they're going to issue some kind of decision and document. So, again, if the synod is about everyone participating, well, now we're told, no, everyone isn't going to participate. In fact, the synod itself is simply going to be consultative to the doctrine of the faith. Now, that proceeds from the question of why in the world are we studying a question that's already been answered? Women cannot be ordained to holy orders, so there's no need for further study. But the fact is, endless studies is a tactic and trying to wear down opposition.
Mm. Bob, the synodal document makes glancing reference to differences of the sexes and reciprocity between the sexes. And it ends with a call to, quote, give fuller recognition to the charisms, vocation, and role of women to better honor this reciprocity of relations in all spheres of the church's life, end quote. Bob, what do you make of that? I mean, what does reciprocity of relations mean to you?
I wish I could give you a clear answer to that, Raymond. I really don't know. And look, this whole language, this language about having to bring women into a kind of a more equal position in the church with men, this is sort of political language. I don't like privileging any group on the basis of sex, nationality, race, whatever. As in the secular world, what we want is people who are competent and people who are good at a job, whether they're male or female, Europeans, Africans, Americans. It seems to me that the church should recognize the contribution of women as appropriate. But you rightly say, we've had these discussions about deacons and deaconesses. And my suspicion about this is that what they're going to do is they're going to try to find a type of para ministry that is going to, in all respects, be a deacon's role. They won't call it deaconess, but there'll be a kind of a para status that they're going to try to establish by some sort of, invention of language. Because that's the only reason you keep going back and back to this. The Pope himself has said no, that they can't be ordained right. as deaconesses in that famous interview with Nora O'Donnell on CBS. So I think Father is right. You keep repeating this stuff, so you soften up the ground a little bit, and then you kind of give a semi-ordained status to women. I don't think that it can be anything other than that that's the aim.
Yeah. I want to share a bit more of this synodal working document with you. Now people hear this synodal talk, and they don't really know what's being said. This passage speaks about what they mean by synodal church, about listening. I'll read it to you. Synodality, therefore, designates the particular style that qualifies the life and mission of the church, a style that starts from listening as the first act of the church. Faith, which is born from listening to the proclamation of the good news, lives from listening to the Word of God, listening to the Holy Spirit, listening to one another, listening to the living tradition of the church and its magisterium. In the stages of the synodal process, the church once again has experienced what the scriptures teach. It is only possible to proclaim what one has heard. Now, Father, your thoughts about listening as the church's first act.
Well, I'll say respectfully, that's completely wrong, because who is the church listening to? Itself? No, the church proclaims the word. We don't make a separation between the word proclaimed and the church proclaiming it. The church is the mystical body of Christ. So Christ came into the world not to listen, but to teach. He already knows what we need. And in fact, that's part of the problem that this whole synod has created. The idea seems to be coming across. The church has no idea what it needs to do until we ask everybody to tell us what we should do. No, we know what we have to do. We have to preach the gospel. And the gospel is primarily about getting to heaven. It's about the kingdom of God and living according to kingdom ways in this world so we can be with God forever. So, you know, the idea of listening, politicians use that all the time, going on a listening tour.
Yeah.
they've already told us what they believe in. They just want to get confirmation from the voters, and they'll adjust it as the voters, you know, complain. So, no, we have to listen to each other in the church, but that's a secondary thing. The first thing is we have to turn to God and say, teach us, Lord. And the church is the one doing the teaching. The church is not listening to the people in the first place.
Yeah. You know, Bob, the thing that jumped out at me as I saw that quote is this idea of style. This is a style of the church. It's a style of governance. No, the church doesn't have a style. The church is eternal. It's the truth. Styles come and go. So the language itself sort of convicts the argument. But this sounds an awful lot like people straining to hear the spirit of Vatican II while ignoring the letter of all that preceded it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Look, one of the things that I think this listening points toward is people keep saying, what is synodality? And the answer comes back that it's not a thing. It's a process. It's a style. It's a way of being church. And in fact, there are some of the sections of the working document actually talk about this sort of pathways and whatnot. And of course, we ought to listen to one another. That's a natural part of being a human being, let alone being Catholics in the Catholic Church. But this can't possibly be the defining element of what the church is. And I think Father is exactly right that the church exists to go out and proclaim the truth of the gospel to the entire world. Now, they do talk in places about listening to one another so that we can do that proclamation in the best possible way. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. But this almost obsession with the idea of listening tells us that there's just something very odd about this whole concept of synodality, as if we don't have anything that we're confident enough we can preach. Of course we have something that we can preach. We've received in Revelation from God himself and through the history of the mm-hmm. church, many, many things that people are perishing from, the lack of at this point. And just to listen to one another, I think of the synod on young people, where the young people came in and said, tell us, teach us, and the older people there were saying, we want to listen to you.
Yeah, that's exactly. What a great example. I mean, and, you know, I as I listened to you, I was thinking of Mother Angelica, who, you know, here was a nun who started this entire enterprise, this broadcast empire, when she was, you know, 52 years old, 54 years old, when it finally launched. And she had such a clear conviction of the power of truth and the power of what had already been revealed and was protected by the church. All she felt needed doing was broadcasting that, spreading that. She wasn't listening to anybody. They were listening to her. And in the 80s and 90s, she fought this war against inclusive language in the translations of the gospel. She thought she was victorious. Well, Mother, it's 1993 all over again. The Synod will be discussing, you guessed it, inclusive language. Here's the from the working document. The Episcopal conferences continue to call for greater attention to be paid to the use of language that is more inclusive and to a range of images from scripture and tradition in preaching, teaching, catechesis, and the drafting of official church documents. Father Jerry, language that is more inclusive. As a pastor, is this a pressing problem in the church right now?
No, this is a conceit of liberal elites that, and it's an attempt to manipulate thought through language. The word man and mankind is clear to everybody. It means men and women. So when you say, you know, Jesus is the son of man, it doesn't mean he's only he's the son of males. This whole thing is an attempt to say that we have patriarchal oppression, that male domination of the world and the church is an evil. We have to fight it. So we have to change the way Jesus spoke. And, you know, I'm always annoyed when I'm reading the gospel and I say to myself, you know, this is not right. Perfect example. Now we read at Mass, one does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. Instead of saying man does not live alone. So I'm always joking, well, maybe one doesn't live alone, but maybe two can get by. You know, I mean, this is silliness. We have to, fidelity to the revealed word means the revealed word was chosen by God. Therefore, we're not the ones in charge of choosing it to please basically power-hungry people who want to overthrow, civilizational standards of language.
Hmm. Yeah. How long before we hear, and Jesus approached the demoniac, and they them trembled at the Lord's approach? I mean, I'm waiting for that to happen. Gentlemen, given the recent and ongoing assault on the traditional Latin Mass, I want to get your thoughts on these two passages. A synodal church is a church that listens, is capable of welcoming and accompanying, and is perceived as home and family. The working document speaks about people who, for different reasons, are or feel excluded or on the margins of the ecclesial community. This lack of welcome leaves them feeling rejected, hinders their journey of faith and encounter with the Lord. In the church, the exercise of authority does not consist in the imposition of an arbitrary will, but rather constitutes a moderating force in the common search for what the Spirit requires as a ministry at the service of the unity of the people of God. Bob, who are these marginalized people that the document refers to, and how is the suppression of the old Mass anything but the imposition of an arbitrary will at this point?
Well, I think we know who the marginalized people are. They're women, they're LGBT. Occasionally they mention the poor or people who are socially outcast or whatever, but it really is the women and LGBT, I think. It's not adherence of the traditional Latin Mass, and we know why that is. Actually, I'd like to add something about that, because I've been thinking about this lately, that there's been such an amount of cruel energy applied to the traditional Latin Mass, and I think that's the only way to describe it, that somebody or some buddies in Rome must really think that there is some energy, some threat to something that they hold dear among those people who are largely young people. I used to say there were, you know, there was a tiny minority in the church, but I think more and more they're kind of representing what Benedict was talking about way back when he said that, you know, the church is going to be smaller and purer, but it's going to be more powerful in that pureness. So, you know, we look at this as an injustice and a cruelty to the people who love the traditional Latin Mass. But also, I think we got to recognize this as a sign that there are people who see, who are not adherents of that Mass, but who see that there's a power there that they're very wary of.
Mm. Father, I'm going to ask this. After reading that long excerpt, is anyone listening to this? I mean, the language, as you referenced at the top, it's so distorted and convoluted and disconnected from the lived experience of those of us in the world. At what point do the faithful start to tune all of this out, or have they already done so?
Yeah, nobody I know of in the parish asked me what's going on at the synod, except to say, is there mischief going on? No, I mean, the people who watch this program, and then I see them in different venues, they say thank you because they say you help us to understand what's going on. By definition, synod on synodality is not really even understood by the people in charge of it, because as Bob said, it's a style, you know, and you're pointing out styles change. I mean, if it thinks constantly in flux, then there is nothing there. Essentially, what's going on here, it seems to me, is a process to soften up opposition to pretty predictable changes. You know, there's a large part of this document concerns power sharing, and they basically want to commit, you know, the bishops of the world to submit to committees of lay people having oversight and approval power over their decisions.
As you mentioned there, Father, I was shocked at the confused reportage I read that there were no controversies in this new synod document, as if they're discussing the lengths of cassocks for a month or something. But I want viewers to see this because it seems pretty controversial to me. The document insists on the following. It is difficult to imagine a more effective way to promote a synodal church than the participation of all in decision-making and taking processes. This participation takes place based on a differentiated responsibility that respects each community member and values their respective skills and gifts in view of a shared decision, Now, Father, what exactly is this calling for, this shared decision-making in the church, and how big a theme is it here?
No, they go so far to say that the synod will be a failure, it won't be a success if this isn't implemented. Essentially, this is going toward this committee-style exercise of power, that bishops will not be allowed to make decisions without having first cleared it with a panel, which will include lay women, that they stress that, laymen, and who knows, priests, deacons, religious. So what we're doing here is we're trying to rearrange what Jesus himself said. The shepherds are now going to have to get permission, in effect, from the sheep before they can take them out of the corral and go to a specific pasture to be grazed. This is backwards. This is, unfortunately, heading in the direction of Protestantism, you know, where you have no priesthood, you have lay people getting together and making things, decisions together. This is not how the church is ordered. It really is an assault on the essential structure of the church. And I say that quite clearly. This is not simply an idea. Let's hear people what they have to say. When you say shared decision making, you're basically saying, bishops, you're no longer in charge here.
No, this is like the Lord saying, you know, I am leaving you in control. What you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven after you check with the panel and the consulting group and a couple of others, and then you can do what you'd like. Bob, the document also endorses by name the synodal path, an assembly of bishops and an ecclesial assembly. Is this the new style of governance, and is this the real grand finale of the Synod on Synodality as you see it?
Well, like all these other concepts, it's hard to know what exactly is going to be that this means, because you see other passages in the document that seem to contradict what's there. When they talk about consultation, they want consultation, but they want to change the canon law because they don't want consultation to be only consultation. I think that this really points to a wholesale redefinition of the governance of the church, because there are even passages about how a synodal style points to the true exercise of the hierarchical nature of the church. Now, as we know from even what's happened in the process of synodality, what happens is the guy at the top makes a lot of decisions. He decides he's going to have 10 study groups, and you know, and there are going to be 5 working groups inside. But at the same time, there's all this language about how there's going to be this consultation and people. It just seems to me that this is so vague, and it invites so many problems that I can't conceive of how it can be implemented, which is going to be a third phase after all this talk is over. I don't know what it is asking us to implement. And to me, I think we know that people who don't always have the church's best interest in heart are going to take advantage of some of those openings.
Well, then we have to have the synod on the implementation of the implementation of the synod. That'll be the next event. Directly related to the synod on synodality, among the experts appointed to this 2024 synod will be a controversial priest, Father Maurizio Ciaudi. Now, he was a member of the Pontifical Academy of Life, who has stated that contraception is open to theological discussion and that homosexual acts can sometimes be morally good. Ciaudi will be one of 7 experts on the doctrinal, pastoral, and ethical issue panels at the synod. Father, what does this appointment, I hate to devolve into the bureaucracy of all this, but what does that appointment tell us about the thrust, the direction of this synod?
It tells us that the person making that decision thinks that Father Ciaudi's opinions are valid and worth listening to, which is shocking and quite frankly maddening. Someone who denies the moral teaching of the church should not be the one preparing any moral teaching coming out of the synod. And we're at a crisis in the church when dissenters from Humanae Vitae and from the church's teaching on the immorality of homosexual acts, when someone who falls into the category of a dissenter is now an arm of the doctrinal office of the church, we're in a real crisis. Quite frankly, this is not unexpected, but it is a sign that the synod is trying to lead people away from the traditional church teaching of the church, and that is very, very dangerous.
Bob, when we spoke about this, you said we should focus on these hand-selected discussion groups. Why? Why is that kind of the stalking horse in the synod?
Well, these study groups, there are 10 study groups, and this is a deliberate decision made by authorities. In other words, this is not a decision that was made synodally within the synod, to remove all the controversial issues, women's ordination, LGBT questions, remove that from the discussion of this second October, this upcoming October, and place them in the hands of these private study groups, which are not required to reach final conclusions until June of 2025, which will be over 6 months after the end of the formal synod in October. And so those hot-button issues, and it's not only homosexuality and deaconesses, there are lots of other things about the structuring of the church, those are going to take place not in a synodal style, but in a closed group that is then going to present its findings to the Holy Father and presumably to others in the synodal structure. So I really think that the vague discussion could point in a variety of directions and unfortunately probably will take us in a variety of confusing directions. But those 10 groups are going to have a much more directed activity, and what they bring back to the structure of the synod, I think, is going to be determinative of a lot of things that may raise eyebrows.
Yeah, well, I think we've been covering these synods for so long. We know how these things proceed. They hand select the study groups or the discussion groups, and the outcome is exactly as was predicted by the people you chose. So to me, there's no news here. It's simply a fait accompli that they're going to go through a kind of performative month and have little events and rituals. And then at the end, we're going to end where we began. So we'll cover it, but I do think it's a huge distraction, and it digs up and reopens closed issues and issues that have long been settled in the canon of the church, or what was, I guess, formally the canon of church teaching. I want to move on to Marco Rupnik, this saga. We've been covering this story of the disgraced and ubiquitous alleged sexual abuser from the very beginning. 20 women have accused Rupnik of abuse. His, what I describe as hideous mosaics, are in chapels and major cathedrals all over the world. He was promoted by the Pope, his friends at the Vatican, and there are ongoing discussions now about whether to remove his artwork. At Lourdes, the bishop has decided to do nothing for the time being, but feels that eventually the work should be removed. The Supreme Knight of the Knights of Columbus, Patrick Kelly, has told EWTN News that they have decided, the Knights have, to cover up Rupnik's art, which covers and decorates their chapel at the John Paul II Shrine in D.C. and at their headquarters in Connecticut. Bob, your reaction, and then Father.
Yeah, you know, normally I'm not in favor of censorship of art. But in this case, we know that his artwork, several women have actually said this, religious women too, that his blasphemous, we don't even have to go into the details of this, but his blasphemous ways of proceeding with sometimes two women using the chalice at the altar, etc., those he said were integral to his production of his art. So what we have is art that I have to say has a demonic element in it. And this is not just, you know, an artist who has a less than ideal private life, but his artwork is good. These two things, the abuse and the artwork, I'm sorry to say this, they are one. And so yeah. I'm not surprised that the Knights have decided to cover up the Rupnik artwork up in New Haven. I'm not surprised that the bishop in Lourdes has, I think he's actually turned the lights off in the evening so that they aren't as prominent.
Yeah,
can't
see it.
You can't see it as well. But maybe he's just waiting for the controversy to go by, and then they're going to have to chip out those mosaics. But something has got to be done about this. This isn't just the normal, the artist is less than a perfectly moral man.
Yeah. Father, there is a diabolical quality to the production of these mosaics.
Well, obviously, the crimes that he is accused of, and I think these crimes will soon be proven in a canonical process, I certainly believe the witnesses, the victims who have come forward, these crimes, as Bob said, were integral to his vision of life. He had this false pseudo-mysticism of eroticism and bodies together and all this nonsense. No, cover this stuff up, get rid of it. There's plenty of instances in history where art, politicized art, was used to promote evil, and that's gone. So I would say an art that is the fruit of an evil view of life mixed with this false pseudo-mysticism, this has no place in worship and in people's consciousness when they're trying to talk to God in a chapel or at a shrine.
Father, you know, it astounds me, and I am enraged, frankly, that we were so quick to jackhammer beautiful high altars that took decades to build, and gorgeous altar rails and the baldacchinos in churches all over the world. That went down in an instant. But we debate whether to take down this cheap mosaic from this guy who was expelled by his own order and excommunicated before he was unexcommunicated. I've never seen anything like it. I think we shouldn't even be having the discussion. It should all come down instantly. Or better yet, whitewash it. Do that today. That could be very easily done. I want to move on to the big story of last week, which connects to excommunication. On Friday, the Vatican announced the excommunication of Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano, for the former nuncio to the United States, for the crime of schism. Vigano has been a lightning rod of controversy for years. Father, what do you make of the charge against Archbishop Vigano? Does it hold up canonically? Let's start there.
Yes, the charge of schism is that you refuse to recognize or submit to the authority of the Roman pontiff or to those in communion with him. And Archbishop Vigano was charged with that. He was found guilty by this extrajudicial administrative process. I read the charge sheet that was Vigano himself published on the internet.
Right.
And I think the Vatican has proven the charges. I note that Archbishop Vigano refused to answer the summons to be part of the administrative process. And he didn't simply on the basis of, well, I don't want to testify. It was that he rejected their right to judge him. So for me, that is a sign that he is, in fact, engaged in a schismatic act. I hope and pray he'll repent of it. But I think the punishment is appropriate. And I think the Vatican properly followed canon law in doing this.
Well, but Bob, Vigano's revelations, that testimony that he wrote initially triggered the investigation of Theodore McCarrick and what the Vatican and the Pope did or did not know. What is most striking to me is the lightning speed with which the Vatican acted on this, giving Vigano essentially the same swift, as you mentioned, Father, extrajudicial trial that they gave McCarrick. Only Vigano's excommunicated, while McCarrick, a sexual child abuser, isn't. Your thoughts on this? I'll let Bob respond, and then Father can finish us up.
Yeah, I agree with Father that I think that what he has done warrants the punishment. Whether it's prudent to do that at this point in history, I don't really know. We talked about at the time the things that he had to say about what was going on with McCarrick and, you know, the internal machinations inside the Vatican itself, that were some people protecting McCarrick and some people going after him. And I regret that he kind of went down this path, because what he said at the beginning was crucial for all of us. We needed to know that. We needed to know that there were problems and that Francis had kind of lifted whatever those restrictions that Benedict had placed on McCarrick. We've never really gotten clear what those restrictions were or how they were removed. But in any case, that was a sparking point. That really set off the whole thing. Unfortunately, then he's gone further and further away. He's denying that the Pope is a legitimate Pope. He's denying that Vatican II was a legitimate council of the Church. And he's gotten into, you know, secular politics, and he's supporting Putin as a Christian savior. I think all this is really unfortunate, because I met him several times. You probably did too, Raymond, when he was here. I always thought of him as a good man, but that I think the isolation has just taken him further and further away from his best self.
Yeah, no, he definitely went off the rails, you know, but was certainly an instrument early on for clarity and transparency, and we would never have heard of, I think, had a full airing of the McCarrick affair had it not been for Vigano exposing it, being willing to expose it at first. But then, you know, as often happens, sometimes these people just go right off the rails. Gentlemen, despite denials from the Vatican that another document may be coming further restricting the use of the traditional Latin Mass, the Dicastery for Divine Worship issued a directive to the Archdiocese of Oviedo in Spain, stating that pilgrims of Our Lady of Christendom are forbidden to celebrate the traditional Latin Mass at the end of their pilgrimage, as they have done for many years. The directive comes less than a month before the event. Father, again, swift action from the Vatican against a traditional Catholic practice. Why? Who is this harming?
It's not harming anyone, in my opinion. I think, in fact, the spread of the traditional Latin Mass under the pontifex of John Paul II and Benedict benefited the Church as a whole. And the actions now by the Dicastery for Divine Worship have a dictatorial flavor. I mean, they are saying that this Mass cannot be celebrated in different events here. And they're justifying it by saying, well, in the Pope's accompanying letter to Traditionis Custodes, he said that people will have to return to the new Mass at some point. Well, you know, the Pope, he has that wish. He didn't give a deadline. You know, this is not a legally enforceable category that the Pope wishes people to come back to the new Mass. They still have a right. Traditionis Custodes did not abrogate every aspect of Summorum Pontificum, the document of Pope Benedict. You know, why is it that a priest of the Fraternity of St. Peter can celebrate that Mass every single day in churches entrusted to the fraternity, but then if you go, you know, 3 miles away and there's a group of 10,000 pilgrims, they can't have the Mass celebrated by, you know, the chaplain there at the shrine? This is arbitrary. It betrays a mentality of hostility. I hope the Holy See will pay attention, because this contradicts the Church is for Everyone motif, which is now being used in the Synod and elsewhere to try and change the way the church operates. If anything, we should allow the church to worship God in a way that produced saints over a millennium.
Hmm. In what might be the beginning of a very public backlash against the Vatican action and diminishment of the traditional Latin Mass, a group of leading Britons issued an open letter last week in the Times of London petitioning the Vatican not to restrict or ban the Latin Mass. The signatories included Sir James Macmillan, Julian Lloyd Webber, Lord David Alton, Bianca Jagger, among others, a diverse ecumenical group. And they're arguing on both secular and cultural grounds, as well as about the beauty of the Mass, that it shouldn't be denied the world as part of the cultural heritage. And it echoes a similar letter written back in 1971, which Agatha Christie signed. Bob, what do you think of this effort? Will we see more of this?
I hope we do. And I'm glad that, in one way, it's a limitation to say that this is a cultural and aesthetic treasure, which is true, but it's only partial to what a Catholic understands as the traditional Latin Mass. And I'm going to repeat myself, but then we're in a synodal church and we repeat ourselves for emphasis, I guess. There's a reason why I think the Vatican played down the Latin Mass that Cardinal Mueller said at Chartres when 20,000 mostly young people went on that pilgrimage to Chartres. And now this Covadonga situation. What I'd like to repeat is I think that they sense that there is real spiritual power there. And that's why, for some reason, they can't bear that in these special events, you have a Latin Mass that really speaks to everybody. That's the heritage of all of us, whether you grew up in a vernacular Mass church or the Novus Ordo church. This is a sort of a common point, and especially in these international events, what is going to be the common language? It's not going to be English. It's not going to be, even if you're going to have the Novus Ordo and there are other vernaculars, it's not going to be common to everyone. The traditional Latin Mass is the Mass of the ages. It's the Mass of everyone in the Catholic Church, and I think we can tolerate it on some special occasions.
Father, do these public letters, do you think they have any impact in Rome?
I think so, because the history of not only this pontificate, but previous pontificates is when there's a media storm, then the Holy See pays attention and reacts. So I think it's all to the good. And really, in a synodal church, isn't a sign of the times, the fact that people get on social media and in other forms of media to make their opinions known. I think it is. So, yeah, I mean, God bless those people in England. It's a tragedy when what is the holy worship of God that was celebrated at the Second Vatican Council is now qualified as an unacceptable form of worship that must be stamped out. That is a contradictory and false statement, and sad to say it's operative right now. We need to say, let the Mass be celebrated, let God be worshiped, let the people have peace in their form of prayer.
Yeah. I was traveling a few weeks ago, and we were driving down the street, and it was Sunday, and we passed a church, and overflowing down the steps of the church were all these families. The doors were open, and they were on their knees. Mass was going on. It was a Latin Mass inside. All these young families literally kneeling out in the sun to take part in this Mass. Something is happening, and I agree with Bob and you, Father. I think certain officials are terrified by what they're seeing and the mysterious divine power that it summons and raises not only in the hearts of the faithful, but in the Mass itself. Following contentious elections recently in Great Britain and France, where nationalist and conservative candidates made unusually strong showings, Pope Francis denounced populism this week, calling it the dross of ideology. Speaking in the northeastern Italian city of Trieste, he said, "It is evident that democracy is not in good health in today's world. Ideologies are seductive. Some people compare them to the Pied Piper of Hamelin. They seduce you, but they lead you to deny yourself. Let us not be deceived by easy solutions. Let us instead be passionate about the common good, the Pope said. Your thought, Bob, your reaction to those comments, and then your thoughts on what we're seeing in this American presidential contest, where President Biden is clearly in full collapse, his party's calling for his ouster, and Trump is surging in many of these swing states.
Well, I agree with the Pope that democracy is not in great shape, but not for the reasons that he thinks. He's very much committed to increased immigration, which in both Europe and the United States is a losing proposition. Large majorities of people, even if they don't vote against it, just see that as a threat to their own way of life. And the way that that kind of immigration and other decisions that are made by mostly elites who claim to be defending democracy ignore the people is hardly democratic. People feel like they're losing the identity of their nations. So it's not that these are easy or superficial solutions. It's that people are actually proposing solutions because they feel that something has gone profoundly, radically, basically wrong with the political processes. Now, I'm sure that the Holy Father is not delighted that Donald Trump seems to be pulling ahead here in the United States. But why is that? It's because utterly improbably the Republicans now seem to respond to the common people. The Democrats always thought that they were the party of the working class. It certainly was the case when I was growing up. But something has flipped here. There's another dynamic in which what seems to some people, and I think the Pope, to be anti-democratic or destructive of democracy is actually the voice of the people. So how can that not be democratic? We're going to see more of that. We're going to see more of it. And I don't think that the Vatican is going to have much effect in trying to stop it.
Father, look, a call to the common good is part of the church social teaching. It's great to hear the Pope talk about that. His analysis of nationalism, though, that we're seeing really ignite these elections all over the world. I mean, John Paul II, in many ways, was a nationalist for his mother country, Poland. Your thoughts on that analysis and how that might play not only in Europe, but in the future of America as we move toward these presidential elections?
You know what? Each country has different situation, but I think nationalism is used as a euphemism for conservatism because most of these, what they call nationalists, are basically people who promote traditional morality. I wish the Pope were more upset by the fact that the French Parliament recently put the right to abortion as a constitutional right. I put it this way. I agree with Bob 100%. People say democracy is threatened when people go out and vote for someone that they disagree with. No, democracy lives where people have the right to freely vote for whom they want to. It's up to the elites. It's up to the people. Everybody who's in the political arena, make your case. And, don't rely on the fact that, if we don't get the vote we want, then we're going to subvert it. No. So that's my thought.
So, Father, you're really calling for a synodal nation. That's what you want, a synodal nation that listens to everybody. I get it. I think I'm getting it. Finally, an article appeared in the New York Times this week, which I have to get your reaction to. I thought about you all as I read it. America's New Catholic Priests, Young, Confident, and Conservative was the headline. Here's a bit of the interior of the article. In an era of deep divisions in the American Catholic Church and ongoing pain over the continuing revelations of sexual abuse by priests over decades, there is increasing unity among the men joining the priesthood. They are overwhelmingly conservative in their theology, their liturgical tastes, and their politics. I think the last is what probably upsets the New York Times most. Bob, the article states that over 80% of priests ordained since 2020 describe themselves as theologically conservative or orthodox, or very conservative or orthodox, according to a CUA poll. What do you think of those numbers and the article?
Yeah, I was really astonished by the fact that the New York Times would even publish such an article. It's true, of course. It's very easy to look at the Catholic Project at Catholic University has done this survey, and it's very clear what the results of that survey are. But look, if you start to think about this logically, in this day and age, They bring up, of course, right at the beginning, the ongoing pain of abuse in the church, because they always have to remind us of that. Never about, you know, teachers in public schools or, you know, coaches or whatever. But if you're going to be a priest these days, it's not the old church and it's not the old society in which there's a great deal of prestige. In fact, you're probably going to come up against a lot of headwinds if you want to do that. And if you want to really do it and you just go through seminary and get yourself ordained, it's probably because you think that there's something there in the church that the world cannot give. And I'm delighted that in this country, that is beginning to manifest itself. I don't care so much about the politics, although, you know, these things are now interrelated in ways that they maybe weren't in the past. But it's a sign of hope that the men who are now being ordained, who decide that God has called them and they're going to pursue this, they're going to make a difference in the world. And our country, I think more than most, I can't really even think of any place else where this is the case, is in that respect at least quite vibrant, even if there is still a great deal to do. So, look, it's a great thing. It's remarkable that the Times noticed it without trying to undermine too much. And let's all just celebrate it.
Father, might this be, and I think Bob mentioned it earlier, or maybe you did, Benedict XVI's great vision that the church would be smaller but more vibrant and therefore more influential. Might these young priests end up being a check on the confusion and the innovation we see coming from Rome and other parts of the world, and frankly, that we have to report on every week?
The young priests are went to the seminary because they believed in God, they believed in the doctrine of the faith, they believed in the value of the sacraments, and they believe in the life of prayer. So when you have people believe in all that good stuff, you're going to have vibrant parishes and schools, and you're going to have, you know, a life of faith that's alive. What I think scandalizes the New York Times and then people who agree with its editorial line is that all of this stuff is supposed to disappear, you know, in liquid modernity. And we stand with Christ, and we read the Bible not as a subject for revision, but for belief and acceptance. So I'm certainly pleased, as, you know, I frequently tell you, Raymond, travel around to different places, and I meet young priests. They watch EWTN. They're grateful for it, and they thank us, the Papal Posse, because we help them to understand why doctrine matters, why what Mother Angelica's vision was so important. You know, when you bring up Mother Angelica, I always smile because I say to myself, what in the world would she think of a church in which all the doctrines she was taught as a young nun are now supposed to be a subject for dialogue, revision, and listening sessions? No. The young priest, no. They're a sign that Mother Angelica knew what she was talking about. Stick with Jesus, stick with his church, and God will help you. That's what it is.
Yeah. Well, that's a great way to end this and, you know, tie a bow around it. We referenced this earlier. The church and the teachings of the church are eternal. They're forever because they proceed from God himself. You don't have to update it. You don't have to innovate on it. You don't have to try to find a new style to wrap it in or a new way to present it to the people. Just give it to them unvarnished. It works and it endures. Gentlemen, we will leave it there for commentary by Robert Royal and Father Gerald Murray, including their regular conversations. You can go to thecatholicthing.org. Thank you both. And that is all the time we have for now. We'll be preempted next week for EWTN's live coverage of the National Eucharistic Congress, but we'll be back July 25th. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.